This week, a ruling by an appeals court in St. Louis brought the NFL players and owners back to the bargaining table, offering hope to beleaguered fans. And then just a few minutes before midnight last night, the players who sued the league for antitrust violations filed a court brief accusing the NFL of acting like a cartel. Maybe not the most hopeful sign. But there was a time when the future of the game was much more precarious than it is today. In the early 1900s, universities were dropping the sport due to injuries and deaths. State legislators were considering banning it, and it took an act of the sitting president of the United States to bring about change. John J. Miller tells the story in his new book, The Big Scrum, How Teddy Roosevelt Saved Football. And he joins me from NPR in Washington. Mr. Miller, welcome to Only a Game.
Thank you.
In 1905, the game of football didn't look much like the modern version. How was the game played, and why did so many people want to ban it?
In 1905, 18 people died playing football. They were on the big-time college level all the way down to the sandlot level. They were dropping dead back in those days. And that's because, in large measure, the sport was different from how it is now. It was a lot more like rugby back in the early days. Think of it as a series of goal line stands on the 50-yard line over and over and over again. Big men crashing into each other, forming piles. The problem was severe enough that a prohibition movement rose up. A group of people led by the president of Harvard University, who was Charles W. Eliot at the time, The Nation magazine, muckraking journalists. They said it was a blood sport. They compared it to gladiatorial combat in the Roman amphitheater. They said, there's no place for this in modern American life. We must prohibit the sport. So they crusaded against it, and it took Theodore Roosevelt to save the game.
So let's get to that. Theodore Roosevelt was arguably football's most influential supporter, and Harvard President Charles Eliot was one of football's greatest detractors. They were both proponents of a movement called Muscular Christianity. What was Muscular Christianity?
So in the middle of the 19th century, a lot of Americans were concerned about the fitness of their country. Were people getting enough exercise? People were moving from the countryside into the city. They were taking jobs in factories. Life, in a lot of ways, was becoming more sedentary. In the middle of the 19th century, people said, we've got to do something about this. And so a social and religious movement rose up called Muscular Christianity that says, to be a good Christian, you need to take care of not only your soul, but also your body. And the most obvious manifestation of it that we still know about today is the YMCA movement. And this was an aspect of muscular Christianity. This is sort of the social, political, and religious context into which these games are born.
So how did Roosevelt and Eliot come to interpret this muscular Christianity so differently?
Well, Roosevelt attended Harvard University, and in 1876, as an 18-year-old freshman, he watched his first football game. He and a bunch of friends got on a train in Cambridge and went down to New Haven. They watched the second ever football game played between Harvard and Yale. He thinks this is great entertainment. It's great fun to watch. Over time, he becomes convinced that football and rough sports like it are socially useful. They're socially useful because they help turn boys into men, and they help make them into men who can lead America forward into a new century. And he's become such an advocate of this idea that when he recruits the Rough Riders, we all know the story. He goes out to San Antonio and wants to recruit a bunch of cowboys and Westerners to be in this unit that's going to fight with him in Cuba. And that's basically true. But if you read his memoirs, he also says he wants football players. And he signs them up. They go to Cuba with him. So he saw football as not just a piece of mere entertainment, but actually a social good. Charles Eliot, on the other hand, most important man in the history of higher education in the United States. He's the one who made Harvard a great school. He was president for 40 years, longer than anybody before or since. He believed in physical fitness. He believed in exercise. He engaged in a lot of it himself. But he did not like football. He did not like the violence. He thought it was an ungentlemanly sport and had no place in modern American life. So he and Roosevelt started butting heads.
Well, what I love about his objections to the sport are so crazy. He equated coaching from the sidelines with cheating, and he thought that feigning a pass was somehow immoral. Have I got that right?
Yeah, it is. It's funny to read him today on this. He didn't like baseball either. He thought if a pitcher threw a curveball, he was engaging in an act of deception, and that's something that gentlemen shouldn't do. He also thought that games that required umpires and referees were unfit for gentlemen, because gentlemen shouldn't require these kinds of arbiters on the field. They should be able to settle their own differences and be sportsmanlike and so on. And it sounds crazy today, but you got to recognize that these sports were just being born back then, and you know, they were making up the rules as they went along, and these were some attitudes that Elliott brought to the sport. Now, when he starts criticizing football's brutality, you got to confess that he kind of has a point. People are getting hurt, some are dying, and he wanted to do something about that.
So Harvard banned football in 1885, but the sport was brought back just a year later when the athletic committee ruled that the game of football has been much improved during the past season. The game hadn't been improved at all, so why did Harvard bring it back?
Well, the sport was becoming more and more popular. Students loved it. Alumni loved it. It was popular in the press. Sports sections and newspapers were being born at this time, and they loved to cover football, you know, then as they do now. And alumni pressure forced the game to come back after a one-year hiatus at Harvard. And there was some concern that Harvard was not keeping up with Yale and Princeton, which never did abandon the sport. And there were also people who said, well, you know, the reason Harvard gave it up is because Yale was actually beating them year after year. So people were poked fun at Harvard for having given it up. But they were only gone for a year, and then they came back and kept on playing. But the violence continued.
My guest is John J. Miller, author of The Big Scrum. You're listening to Only a Game. So President Roosevelt's agenda in the summer and fall of 1905 went something like this: negotiate a peace accord between Japan and Russia, and then get the top men in football together and save the game.
Exactly.
Did Roosevelt really do anything more than say, gentlemen, fix this?
That is what he did, but of course it mattered a lot. In October of 1905, Roosevelt summons to the White House the head coaches from Harvard, Yale, and Princeton, the three biggest and most important college football programs. But Roosevelt didn't issue any orders. He didn't tell them what to do, but he said something has to be done. And so they passed a series of sweeping rule changes, the most important of which is the development of the forward pass. And in doing so, they began to address the violence problem, number one. And number two, they created football as a distinctively American sport. This was the moment when it really separated itself from its origins as a rugby game. And of course, it wanted to become what is today by far the most popular sport in the United States.
Even with these rules, football will never be entirely safe. I suspect that Teddy Roosevelt would be pleased about that.
Roosevelt understood that it was a rough sport. He also understood that there's no such thing as a risk-free activity. He believed that rough sports like football were good for boys, taught them how to deal with adversity, thought a boy getting banged up on a football field and feeling a little sore the next day was probably good for his character. And he thought it helped turn them into great Americans who could lead the country forward.
I really can't resist a what if here. If Roosevelt was alive and president today, what would he say to the NFL owners and players to resolve the current labor impasse?
That's a great question. What we know now about Roosevelt and what he did in 1905 shows that a skillful leader with a deft touch can solve a vexing problem. And, you know, I would welcome the president today taking a couple hours out of his day and solving the lockout. That would be a great use of his time. I don't know that it could be done, but Roosevelt took on a very serious problem back in 1905, and through his intervention, the sport came up with a solution.
John J. Miller's new book, The Big Scrum, is published by Harper. He joined me from NPR in Washington. John, thanks for speaking with me.
Thanks very much.
It's 22 and a half minutes before the hour.
Support for Only a Game comes from the listeners of WBUR Boston, where the program is produced, Harvard University, whose summer school has courses for high school, college, and adults to earn academic credit and experience campus life, summer.harvard.edu, and Oliver Wyman, an international strategy consulting firm. With 3,000 professionals worldwide, Oliver Wyman serves global 1,000 companies. OliverWyman.com. This is NPR.
The Surfing Madonna of Encinitas must go. The 10-by-10-foot stained glass mosaic of Our Lady of Guadalupe on a surfboard appeared overnight under a train bridge in Encinitas, California. The mosaic has plenty of admirers, some of whom have said the artwork is gorgeous, uplifting, and a random act of kindness. But the city says the lady must go. City officials don't object to the Madonna's long flowing gown or to her hands in prayer. They don't even object to the words "Save the Ocean" spelled out in blue letters to her left. No, the city doesn't object to anything about the lady except that she was erected without a public review process. Luckily, some local business people have less stringent review processes. They're hoping to give her a new home on private property.